Good morning and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. We're going to try to cast a little sunshine on the ways in which government is doing and not doing the people's business. Later in today's program, we'll be speaking with Karen Scharf, the Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York State and a co-chair of the Working Families Party. But before we hear from Karen, we're pleased to be joined on the telephone by New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli. Comptroller DiNapoli, thank you for joining us this morning.
Frank, good to be with you. You're reminding me of my early days of the Assembly when we worked together.
This is Brian McDonnell, and I'm delighted to welcome our guest, Tom DiNapoli, to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. A lifelong resident of Nassau County on Long Island, Comptroller DiNapoli was first elected to public office in 1972 when he was elected to the Mineola Board of Education, becoming the first 18-year-old in New York State to hold public office. He served on the school board for 10 years and later served in the New York State Assembly for more than 20 years. He's currently in his eighth year as state comptroller. The person holding the position of state comptroller in New York State government has a wide variety of responsibilities. Among the most well-known of these duties is managing, as the sole trustee, the New York State Common Retirement Fund, the state's main pension fund, making the comptroller one of the largest institutional investors in the world. How's the pension fund doing, Mr. Comptroller, after the rocky times of 2008 and 2009?
Well, Brian, thank you for that great intro and a great first question. Well, we did have a very rough year in 08 and 09, as all investors did, as we all know, and institutional investors like public pension funds were not immune from the Wall Street market collapse, but we've certainly done much better since that year, and last year were able to post a positive return of over 13%. So that's significant because now we've had a number of years since the losses of 08 and 09 on the positive side. Certainly in the context of our long-term goal, which is for a 7.5% rate of return, that's not meant to be an annual or a monthly target. That's a long-term perspective. But when you get a good year like we had, value of the fund March 31st of over 13%, you know that we're certainly on the right trend and renews the confidence that I hope all New Yorkers will share with me that our long-term investment strategy is a smart one and that our pension fund for public employees and public retirees, in fact, is sustainable, unlike what we're reading about in many other states.
Besides the investment performance, you've also made some changes in disclosure. What have you done on the transparency front?
Well, this obviously was a big issue when I first came into office because we found out, unfortunately, through investigations and revelations, that one of the reasons why my predecessor's administration ran into so much trouble is that there was not transparency in how pension fund decisions were being made and management of the fund assets. So we've done a couple things. First of all, to give the larger community a sense of what the status of the fund is, we do quarterly reporting of our performance. What we do now on a monthly basis is we actually post the transactions that are taking place so that people could see where the money's going. I think had that kind of transparency on transactions been in effect years before, some of the problems with the use of placement agents and the corruption that came from that might have been detected a lot sooner. So that is in terms of external transparency what I think has made a big difference. Internally, besides the fact that we have updated and expanded the roster of advisors that we work with, that work with our staff, we also now have something called an internal investment committee so that the heads of the asset classes across the board look at investment transactions before the final recommendations are made by the CIO, and in some cases, ones that I have to sign off on. The bottom line is we have internally more eyes looking at all of our transactions and all of our decisions, and externally, we're communicating where the money's going, how the performance is doing, so it is not an opaque process. It is. We still obviously have certain bits of information that has to protect our investment strategy, but we are cutting edge in terms of transparency. We had an independent fiduciary review of our operations, and Funston Advisory Services confirmed that we are using best practices when it comes to transparency.
In terms of having a yardstick on the system, one of the things the Comptroller's Office traditionally has done, and I think you probably have a policy on how you approach this, is to have a mix of managing some of the pension fund, so to speak, in-house with your own employees and using advisors to manage part.
Yeah.
How does that mix work, and how does it help you to judge how you're doing both internally and externally?
Yeah. Most of our equities, in fact, are managed in-house. We are largely invested in public equities, so the stock market and, you know, the corporate names that everybody would be familiar with. And the vast majority of those assets are managed, as you point out, by our own staff. We do have a small portion that is actively managed. And we review on a periodic basis the performance of our active managers. And if they're not doing well, we sever the relationship and we move on. The area where we have the and this you know, is potentially an area of vulnerability, so you have to be careful with it, where we do have management outside of the office in the sense that we work with funds and we work with advisors that manage our money, is with what we call the alternatives. So, for instance, real estate, private equity. Those are examples of assets that are important because you want to diversify. You don't want to be only with the stock market, and given, you know, the cheapness of money today, you can't be just in, you know, fixed income because it's not generating return. So our fund, like many other funds, has a portion. It's limited by statute how much, but we do have a portion that goes into what we call the alternatives. In New York, we have something called a basket clause that limits how much you could put in that alternatives basket. But that's where we do have money that is given to a fund, given to a manager, and again, we monitor carefully what the performance is, and you know, fortunately for us, in the past year, you know, real estate gave a return of over 18%, private equity over 17%. So these alternatives have been helpful. They are riskier in many ways, and with our consultants managing our money, doing it in the right way and appropriate oversight. But, you know, the reality is you need to have a diversified portfolio. I think that's been one of the strengths of the New York Times.
Appreciate it. You, obviously, in addition to managing the Common Retirement Fund, you have a lot of other responsibilities. You have a great deal of responsibility in New York State. You're responsible for reviewing all proposed state contracts over a certain size before, you know, the state can enter into them. You're reviewing all payments of money from the state treasury before they can be made, conducting audits of state agencies and public benefit corporations, and overseeing the fiscal affairs of local governments, including New York City, none of which are easy tasks in and of themselves. But in conjunction with these duties, you've also expanded your anti-corruption efforts in New York State. And it seems like you've entered into a great partnership with Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. Could you tell us a little bit about those anti-corruption efforts?
Yeah, Ron, we've really had, I'll start with the latter part of your comment, our work with the Attorney General. Eric Schneiderman and I have had an unprecedented relationship that we established at the start of his tenure as Attorney General. He's doing a great job, but he and I spoke, and certainly we understand the importance of restoring the public's confidence in government at the state level and really at all levels. And there just have been too many instances of public officials, often elected, sometimes appointed, who are corrupting the system, very often for personal gain, for monetary gain. And the way this process worked in the past with us is that we would have an audit done, or perhaps one of our investigators would come up with a finding that we would then at some point pass on to law enforcement, often the Attorney General, but could also be a local district attorney or a U.S. attorney. Now, so speaking with the Attorney General, we said, you know, isn't there a more efficient way to get to the bottom of some of these situations? Why don't we cross-deputize our staff? Why don't we have a joint task force, public integrity task force, where early on when, either through our audit findings or perhaps an investigation that the Attorney General's office has going on, if we could have our teams work together as a way, first of all, in a time where, you know, you don't have as many resources as you'd like to have, you can maximize the efficiency by having your teams work together from the beginning. And this has resulted in a much more efficient process. Unfortunately, this is an area where we continue to find officials gaming the system. Wherever there's state money involved, and that's why you've seen what some of the charges that have come out of our efforts, it's not always an elected official or even a public official. It could be someone with a not-for-profit that was getting money, you know, from the state, and that would be our way to track that. And keep in mind, not to get too technical, but our office has the ability to confer a criminal jurisdiction for the Attorney General, who doesn't necessarily have that jurisdiction, by definition. So this has been a great way for us to collaborate, and because of the success of this, we've been expanding our efforts. We don't just work with the Attorney General, though that's an important part of our work. As I mentioned, we work with local district attorneys. We work with U.S. attorneys as well. What I've decided to do, because there's still more work to do in this area, unfortunately, I have elevated our investigations unit within our organization, you know, frankly, to give it a little more priority in terms of how the unit interacts with the rest of our organization. Nelson Sheingold, who's headed it, continues to head it now as a deputy controller. We're going to add more resources to this team, and we're going to keep looking to be sure that taxpayer money is not being wasted, and we're holding accountable officials who are doing wrong.
Mr. Comptroller, you've been a strong advocate of defined benefit pensions, and you've been outspoken speaking about the issue of retirement security. Are we facing a crisis in this country, as many people facing retirement have less savings and fewer pensions than they did a generation ago?
Well, there's no question about it, and it is a crisis that we haven't done an adequate job to address. I was glad in the State of the Union address this year, the president put on the table the notion of coming up with a new savings vehicle as a way to deal with the fact that on the private side, corporations are, you know, continuing to cut back on defined benefit pensions. Not that they're gone totally. Sometimes the sense is that there are none of them left. Well, that's not true. But there certainly are fewer today than there were 20, 30 years ago. And what you're going to have now, you have people living longer, more and more people living into their 90s, meaning they need more income to survive in their golden years. For many people, Social Security and private savings is not enough. They're, you know, the way the economy has been, how many people are able to put money aside for retirement? And so the lack of that defined benefit pension, which had been more traditional in the country years ago, is creating a new class of people who are not going to have adequate resources to provide for themselves. Maybe in some cases their families will be able to make up the difference. In many cases they're going to come back to government, and it's going to cost taxpayers, which is why certainly at a minimum we need to preserve defined benefit plans that we have. And again, in the case of New York, we have a well-managed plan. We have a secure plan. We have a very high funded ratio, meaning having adequate assets to meet our liabilities. And as we have strong investment returns, that ratio gets even higher and higher. So those that argue that defined benefit plans like ours in New York are not sustainable, they're wrong on the facts, firstly. And secondly, the notion of putting more people into retirement insecurity makes no sense at all. So a couple things. We need to preserve the great plans that we have, as we have here in New York, first and foremost, recognize the benefits, not just for those in the system, but the investments made in New York and people staying in New York after they retire. 80% of our retirees stay here, spending money here, an important part of the economic engine for our state are our retiree benefits that stay in the state. But we also have to be more fully engaged in that broader discussion. What can we do to help those that do not have access to a pension plan today because they work at a company that doesn't provide it, or they're self-employed and they haven't had the ability to provide retirement savings? That's where I think the next discussion has to be. There's a lot of ideas floating out there as to how to do that and whether or not public plans can play a role in that. But that should be a societal imperative for all of us, and I hope that as we head into – nothing much is happening in Washington now, because I do think this needs to be addressed nationally, not just state by state. I'm hoping as we head into the next round of presidential discussions that the candidates, and certainly I hope the candidate for the Democratic Party, will talk very foursquare about retirement security and the lack thereof and the need for us to address it.
Thanks. I want to switch gears here a second. One of the other things that you've been focused on. Something near and dear to my heart, something I've been working on for a while, revolves around industrial development agencies and or a lot of these economic development programs, but in particular the IDAs. You've been doing audits on these IDAs for years, and these industrial development agencies are doling out public dollars, whether they be local or state dollars. Many of these economic development programs are not living up to their job creation goals and targets. Certainly the companies that are getting the subsidies aren't meeting their job creation requirements. Seems like we're doing very little in the way of asking these companies to give money back when they don't meet their job creation targets. But you recently reviewed a number of different county IDAs, and clearly you're finding that, you know, we're not getting a real good bang for our buck with these type of programs. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on the work you've been doing to monitor these IDAs and what you think we should be doing to fix them.
Well, we do an annual performance report. We've been doing that for a number of years on IDAs across the state. And then, of course, as you point out, we do specific audits on specific IDAs. And it's very much a mixed bag. You know, some of the IDAs that we, when we do an actual audit on them, we find excessive amount of money spent on staff and operations that aren't very transparent and really questionable in terms of economic development benefit. In some cases, IDAs are managed well, and they are fulfilling a reasonable expectation about promoting economic development. I think the challenge is when you look statewide, there's very little consistency. You know, the history of how certain IDAs were created and certain parts of the state have a number of IDAs arguably competing against each other. You know, you have county level, you have, you know, you'll have town level, you'll have, you know, city level. There's no rhyme or reason to the number of IDAs that we have across the state and where they're regionally located. But I think the bottom line issue for all the IDAs, they're not going away, is that issue of transparency and accountability. And there does need to be more consistency in terms of how the IDAs report on what they're doing, how they're giving out benefits, who's getting them. And your question raises a very important point. When you have a project that has a certain expectation as far as job creation, and it doesn't happen for whatever reason, or, you know, the company gets the benefit, but the jobs aren't created, or it fails completely. What is the accountability to ensure that the benefits that are given, and ultimately, again, it gets back to the taxpayer, that there is some ability, as we say, to claw back or to recoup benefits that are given? And that's something that, you know, has been a proposal that many have advocated for as part of IDA reform. We certainly advocate for that from the Comptroller's Office. There was a slight move in that direction last year as far as state sales tax and an opportunity for clawback, but this is something that really needs to be done across the board for our IDAs, because I think that's how you can ensure you have an appropriate level of accountability. You know, the bottom line is people will be willing to accept the trade-off of giving the benefits and the tax breaks if, in fact, they see real economic development that creates jobs on the ground. And there is not a consistency of that effort. And if the benefit doesn't come back in terms of the jobs being created, then in terms of the monetary benefit, the tax exemption that is given, there should be some ability to recoup that money so it could be used for a better and more appropriate purpose. So, unfortunately, like many other issues here in the state capitol, IDA reform is an issue that's yet to be fully addressed, but we're going to continue to do our audits, issue our annual report, and certainly work with good advocates like you, Ron, in getting the message out that this is an area that we need to do a much better job. And again, it's about accountability, you know, right? It's, everybody uses the word. This is certainly an area where you need more transparency and accountability.
Yeah, we definitely do. Do you think also, I mean, just as a follow-up quickly, there's been kind of a proliferation of these IDAs over the years, and it seems like, you know, you were pointing out we have them at the town level, the village level, the city level, the county level. Should we consolidate these into, you know, one IDA per county or something to that effect, or, you know, a region-wide IDA, yeah, so we're not, you know, cannibalizing each other when it comes to trying to, you know, draw these businesses into our community? Oftentimes you see, you know, a business, you know, in the case of, say, a Beechnut, where the company moved 15 miles down the road, yeah, didn't create any more jobs, and got huge tax breaks.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough because, you know, there was no rhyme and reason in terms of how this is set up. And you look at the map, you look at Western New York, you have a large number of IDAs. You go to other parts of the state, and there might be one or perhaps not any for a large area. You know, the challenge is always how do you undo something like that? And whenever you try to, depending on which level someone is sitting at, they'll argue, you know, the more local IDAs make more sense, not a regional one, and the counties will say, well, we should have, you know, I think the short answer is yes, we should rationalize how IDAs are set up, but I think that's going to be tough because, you know, locally there will be tremendous pressure to keep, you know, the current structures, and, you know, IDAs were set up, you know, by statute, you know, each area. In fact, there was a period of time where I carried a bill to have a town IDA when I was in the assembly. It never happened because it was at a point where I think the legislature even recognized how many more of these IDAs are we going to have. But the local township that I represent, they very much wanted one because they said, hey, you know, we're not getting enough from the county IDA. So I think you're right. We should have a more rational approach, a logical one. How you would undo what you have already, very hard to do.
Right. That's interesting. The state assembly did have a policy it adhered to for a good number of years of not creating additional IDAs. So at least they didn't make the problem worse.
Right. Although, you know, for me going back home, my dad supervisor right. kept saying, hey, how come I can't? And I said, look, you know, there's no rhyme or reason. And unfortunately or fortunately, we're not going to create more of these. But it becomes a local issue.
Right.
Because you get into the politics, right? So especially if you have different parties, right? If one party is controlling the county one and different parties at the local level, the one side says, well, they're not taking care of our projects. It gets way too complicated.
Right. This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've had the pleasure of speaking with State Controller Thomas DiNapoli. Controller DiNapoli, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you, and give my best to Karen Scharf.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Thanks, care, guys.
Controller. At around 8:35 this morning, we will indeed be speaking with Karen Scharf, and we're going to be talking about electoral developments here in New York State with Karen. She's the Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York State, and she's also one of the co-chairs of the Working Families Party that had its statewide convention last weekend at the Desmond Hotel and Colony and got quite a bit of news coverage about that, and we're going to dig into that with Karen. But before we turn to Karen and the current political situation, are there any noteworthy developments that you're involved in following as the legislature heads into the final 3 or 4 weeks of its 2014 regular session? I guess New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness and the Fiscal Policy Institute don't really get involved in things like medical marijuana.
Not as of yet. When there's revenue to be had from it, maybe then we'll get involved with it a little bit more. But, you know, I want to follow up a little bit on what Comptroller DiNapoli was talking about with IDAs, because one of the things that certainly New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness and the Fiscal Policy Institute have been working on is reforming many of these economic development programs, and many of us have been doing so over the years. We recently partnered with a group called Align. They're out of New York City, but are a statewide organization, as well as the Coalition for Economic Justice in Buffalo. We've been working on something called the Jobs Act, which is the Just and Open Business Subsidies Act. And that's really something that would look at the entirety of all these grants and tax credits, economic development monies that we put out the door every year. We're talking $7 billion almost a year. And economic development monies and tax credits and whatnot. So it's an astounding figure, but the problem is we're not being very good stewards of the public's money. There's very little accountability, very little transparency when it comes to these programs. And I think certainly that's what the comptroller's been finding in audit after audit after audit. I guess I'm just wondering, you know, given the nature of these programs and how they're not creating jobs and how much money we're spending on them, doesn't it seem like you know, we should be pulling back on these or curtailing them?
Yes, it does seem like that.
It does seem like that, doesn't it? The question is, why don't we have the political will to do that in Albany?
Well, at some times in history we have, and unfortunately at some other times in history the stars don't align themselves correctly.
Right.
In 1993... a significant package of industrial development agency reforms were enacted when the Democratic chairman of the Assembly Local Governments Committee and the Senate Republican chairman were at least for a while on the same wavelength. And some of the things like, for example, prohibiting the use of IDA subsidies for retail were prohibited except in certain exceptional cases. Not that those loopholes weren't misused over the years.
Right.
But in terms of the jockeying since then, the prohibition on retail has actually been allowed to expire.
Hmm.
So we've actually gone backwards in some ways. So the Jobs Act, it seems to be a comprehensive attempt to put the genie back in the bottle.
Right. Maybe it's just too much of a common sense attempt, I think. Or maybe it tries to do too much. I don't know why legislators are reluctant to pass a bill like this. It seems like it truly is a common sense kind of bill that just tries to, you know, bring some rationale and reason to these programs and how they operate. So it's a little discouraging that year after year this bill gets put on the shelf. But I guess I would suggest that it's probably that, you know, the governor and many legislators like doling out this money to companies around New York State. They love the ribbon cutting ceremonies that they get to go to when, you know, business comes into town and they break ground and talk about job creation. But unfortunately, you know, that seems for the politician, you know, that seems to be the end of the story. You go, you break ground, you do your shovel and throw your dirt. But then they seem to forget about these companies and monitoring whether or not they're actually creating jobs.
Yeah, I think that it's probably not true of all legislators having that view.
Right.
But it's probably too much to expect that individual legislators should have to take on the job of monitoring the performance of their IDAs. We need a system that has more accountability built into it than requiring individual, thinking that individual legislators have the staffs capable of doing that. I think the work that the Comptroller's Office does helps, but we also need to tighten up the laws. You know, I mean, it's while you could say that a lot of the IDA projects don't make a lot of sense, to me, the retail and professional services projects meet the least sense,
right.
Like giving tax subsidies to a new Target store.
Right, or a tax, supermarket.
Or a supermarket or to a doctor's office.
Right.
That shouldn't be allowed. And some IDAs sensibly have policies against that. But as the controller said in our last segment, there aren't uniform policies in terms of what the IDAs do. So whether it's through the Jobs Act, this comprehensive bill that you've been describing, or individual reforms, it certainly is something that's needed. Besides medical marijuana and the Jobs Act, anything else happening before the end of the session? The governor says that he's going to now work hard for a comprehensive public campaign financing system.
Yeah.
If he had trouble getting that done when he was working cooperatively with the Senate Majority Coalition, now since he nominally has broken with them, how does he get them to do that?
Well, so this weekend, right, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this with Karen Scharf, but this weekend the Working Families Party made their endorsement of Governor Cuomo, and it was a long, drawn-out process. And as Frankie just mentioned, the WFP did end up supporting the governor for re-election. And one of the things that the governor said that he would do in exchange for their support is to try and flip control of the state Senate to the Democratic Party. Now, this is something that in his term as governor for the last 4 years, Andrew Cuomo has really not been very interested in. He was very comfortable working with the IDC, the breakaway five members of the Democratic Party who now caucus with the Republican conference. He also agreed to support two of the priorities of the Working Families Party. One is campaign finance reform, and the other is the DREAM Act. Now, you know, we don't have a whole lot of time left in the legislative session, and I think you're right. You know, when he was working cooperatively with the majority coalition, he was able to get some things done. But now that he's effectively thrown them under the bus, how can you hope to sort of navigate the legislative waters? It's going to be very difficult to get something done. And we shouldn't forget 2014 is an election year. And all these guys want to do is go back to their districts and start campaigning again.
Right. Speaking of the independent Democratic, is it called the Independent Democratic Caucus or Conference?
Conference. Yeah.
The Independent Democratic Conference led by Senator Jeffrey Klein whose district is mostly in the Bronx, but also has parts of southern Westchester, Senator Diane Savino from Staten Island, Senator David Valesky from Onondaga and Oneida and Madison counties, and Senator David Carlucci from Rockland County, and their newest member, Senator Tony Avella from Queens. One of their former members, he was a member for at least a little while. He wasn't an original member, but then he joined, but then they threw him out because he got indicted, which didn't seem very nice. And that's former Majority Leader Senator Malcolm Smith. And the news indicated that this week his trial's beginning.
And what a bizarre story this was, right? That in fact, is a longtime Democratic senator from Queens and the former majority leader when the Democrats controlled the state Senate, the story is that Malcolm Smith was offering bribes to Republican party chairs in New York City to secure their line in the 2013 mayor's race in New York City. You know, whenever you think that politics can't get more strange and bizarre in New York State, it does.
You can't make this stuff up.
Well,
sure.
What he was sort of hoping for was another Bloomberg situation, because Michael Bloomberg was a lifelong Democrat and converted to the Republican Party. But the difference was that Michael Bloomberg had billions of dollars.
That's right. That's quite a difference.
Yeah. So hopefully Senator Malcolm Smith gets a fair trial and we find out if he truly did what the prosecution is accusing him of doing, or if it was just mistaken identity. And he really wanted to help build roads in Rockland County.
That must be
for
the
some
case.
Positive purpose.
Of course.
But the Independent Democratic Conference is going to face some rocky times. One of their members, Senator David Carlucci, over the weekend, the Rockland County Democratic Party had its convention, and it adjourned without endorsing him.
Right.
And it now appears that they're looking for a candidate to run against him.
That
right.
seems like an interesting switch. So you've also got Oliver Capel, who's primarying Jeff Klein. No one's announced to primary Diane Savino, or has someone announced to primary Valesky yet, or no?
No, but
sounds like that's in the works as well.
John Liu, former city controller and former candidate for mayor, has declared as a candidate against Senator Tony Avella. I think that's in northeastern Queens.
Yeah, that's going to be something. I mean, John Liu certainly has a lot of name recognition now after the mayoral race that he lost. But
and he's a great speaker, very clear speaker, very good thinker. First Asian American citywide official. There hasn't been an Asian American statewide official yet, but it was elected controller of the city of New York 4 years ago and could have probably been easily reelected to another 4 years as controller, but chose to give up his seat in order to run for mayor.
That's going to be a very interesting election. So Senator Avella is famous for fixing potholes and taking care of his constituents,
right.
But he doesn't raise a whole lot of money. And John Liu, you know, although he had some campaign finance issues when he ran for mayor, is a very effective campaigner. He's a very articulate guy. It's going to be a very interesting race when those two go head-to-head.
Yes. This is WRPI Troy at 91.5 FM over the air in northeastern New York, southern Vermont, and western Massachusetts, and worldwide via the internet at WRPI.org. To help us dig into the major challenges and opportunities facing New York State, we're now pleased to be joined on the telephone by Karen Scharf, the Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York State, and she's also one of the co-chairs of New York State's Working Families Party. Karen, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing this morning, Karen?
Good.
Yeah, this is Ron Deutsch. I also want to welcome you to here to the People's Business on 91.5 FM, WRPI in Troy. Most of our listeners, I would gather, are pretty familiar with Citizen Action and the great work that your organization's been doing for many decades now. You've been at the helm for quite some time, since 1984.
That's true.
Is that correct? Wow.
Yes, that's true.
That's a long time, Karen.
It sure is.
You're a Citizen Action lifer, I think.
Yep.
But why don't you tell us a little bit about Citizen Action as an organization, kind of bring us up to date on some of the state issues that your organization's focused on right now.
Sure. So Citizen Action is a statewide grassroots organization that works for economic, racial, and social justice and environmental justice. And we do that through organizing at the local level in 8 different chapters around the state and then bringing people together around a statewide legislative agenda to win issues at the state level that are really important to people in our communities where we're organizing. And our organization is a pretty diverse organization, both geographically. We're all over the state. People involved are young through old and everything in between, and black, white, and brown. We have our organization is in very poor communities and working-class communities and also has a lot of middle-class activists involved as well. So because of the diversity of our membership, we take on a lot of different issues that people have strong concerns on. Our biggest areas have been education, health care, and campaign finance reform, but we also work very actively on fracking, on minimum wage, and on a host of other issues.
And you've helped us, the Fiscal Policy Institute and New Yorkers Fiscal Fairness, on tax reform issues.
Yeah, tax reform has definitely been a big issue of ours really from our beginning years, because not only do we think that people should pay fair taxes in New York, but we also think we need to have adequate taxes to fund our schools, our healthcare system, and all the other basic functions of government.
This is Brian McDonald. I'd also like to welcome our guest, Karen Scharf, to the People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Besides your work at Citizen Action, Karen, you're also involved in the Working Families Party, and you're one of the state co-chairs. The WFP, as it is known, has been the subject of a lot of news coverage in recent weeks. And before we discuss some of those developments, can you give us a little background on the Working Families Party? When, how, and why did it come into existence, and how did you become involved in it?
Sure. So the WFP was formed in 1998, and as most of your listeners probably know, but I'll spend a few minutes on it, New York has a unique different from most states' electoral system called fusion, where people are allowed to, candidates can run on more than one ballot line. So you can have a candidate who's running as a Democratic candidate and also the WFP candidate at the same time, and the votes on both of those ballot lines add together to give their total for the election. And that that unique situation is what led to the formation of the WFP, because the number of community groups and unions saw an opportunity to create a party that would have a ballot line, but that would also be a coalition of organizations and that would endorse candidates based on a progressive economic justice agenda, and would use that endorsement to get Democrats and Republicans to take positions that were more in favor of economic justice and because they wanted our endorsement, and would also, you know, leave open the opportunity in rare circumstances to run our own candidate if we couldn't find a major party candidate who met our criteria. So the party, for most of its history, is 16 years now, has mostly used that, you know, so-called cross-endorsement, where candidates who are running come into us and they have a major party line and they ask us to also endorse them so they can have the added votes that we can produce on our ballot line. And it allows candidates to get people who may not want to vote on one of the major party lines to get our votes. And we've, you know, gradually over those 16 years been building up greater and greater and greater vote totals every year on our ballot line. And the party was started primarily by Citizen Action, what was then ACORN, CWA, and UAW, with this idea of being able to have a party that stood specifically for economic justice issues and for working class people.
In terms of the structure of the party, you may be a little different than what people think of as political parties. You don't just have people as members. You have organizations as members in some way.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the really interesting things about WFP is sometimes, you know, parties, if they're just individuals and leaders, can go through lots of different evolutions. But the WFP has at its core, and what keeps it, you know, growing and strong and also focused on issues, is that a large number of labor unions in the state, as well as most of the major community organizations in the state that have 501c4s, are involved in the WFP on a day-to-day basis in doing the work of the party and making the decisions of the party. And we have a lot of structures. The party has, on the one hand, its official party structure, which I'll talk about in a second, and then it has its advisory structure, which is where all the organizations are, where people can come in and vote on behalf of what they think, what their organization, not them personally, what their organization thinks the party should do. And in addition, the party has activist chapters of people who are just party members around the state who also have their views of what the party should do. And then at the same time, we have the official party structure that every party in the state has to have under election law, which is a state committee that's chosen based on 2 people per assembly district. And that state committee, what made this past weekend so interesting as we get into that, is what this state committee is what has the power to make statewide endorsements. So when we make endorsements for Senate or Assembly or City Council or Town Board, that's done at the local level by people in these either chapters or structures where different organizations have different votes for the organization, and then it's ratified by the state structure. But on statewide races, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, controller, those decisions can only be made by the individuals on the state committee, and those individuals on the state committee are the 2 people chosen per assembly district in the state. And because of how that works, the state committee is less made up of people from each of the organizations and more made up of individual activists who really believe in the party's values and vision and get on the state committee for that reason. So the state committee has a somewhat different set of views than each of the institutions that make up the party, and a lot of the institutions have very few actual votes on the state committee, unlike the local endorsements. And I think that's kind of the uniqueness and the strength in a lot of ways, as well as, you know, the chaos in some of the weekend of the Working Families Party, is that we've successfully been able to bring together into one party pragmatists and idealists and individual activists and very large institutions, and also a lot of just poor and working class people who are in the WFP to win things like raising the minimum wage and passing the DREAM Act. And those differences were fully on display Saturday. You know, we're a small D Democratic organization. Everyone got to have their say, and people who were there or watched the convention saw all these different parts of the party speaking out for what they thought was the best move for the party right now and its endorsements.
Well, we definitely want to dig into that a little more, and we'll turn it over to Ron to do that in a minute. But let me just ask one more structural question. Karen, in explaining the niche that a party like the Working Families Party can play in New York, you mentioned that we allow fusion, which is more than one party endorsing the same candidate and then being able to add their votes together. My experience, I ran for the county legislature in Schenectady County in 1999, and the local conservative party endorsed me, but the state conservative party was not happy with that.
To your credit, Frank, to your credit.
Fortunately for me, not that I won, but fortunately for me, in the Conservative Party, the rule is that the so-called permission slips, called Wilson-Pakula certificates, for local offices like county legislature are the purview of the county committee, not of the state committee. How does the Working Families Party divide up the power over these permission slips called Wilson-Pakula certificates?
Yeah, and the WFP, those are all decided by the state party. And so informally for local races, we have local committees that make these decisions and make their recommendations to the state level, which are usually just, you know, endorsed. In your situation like yours, it could have happened that it wouldn't be because the state party was in such disagreement with the endorsement of you. But, you know, in 99.9% of the cases, local decisions are signed off on by the state body. But in the WFP, all Wilson-Pakulas are decided at the state level.
Karen, on this show, we've discussed many times that Governor Cuomo has a rather questionable record on progressive economic issues. He's been called by some Governor 1%. Many times he's stood as a friend to the banks in Wall Street. He's taken money from the Koch brothers. I hear that this weekend he made some promises to the party. Can you tell us a little bit about what they were?
Sure. So let me just start by saying that, you know, a lot of people in the party, as I describe the different components of it, you can imagine had some deep concerns about where he's been on economic justice and education issues, and that's what had propelled serious consideration and preparation for a possible run of an independent candidate rather than a cross endorsement, which was quite a lot of enthusiasm for in and outside the party. But there was also, you know, quite a lot strong feelings within the party that it was important to endorse the governor. He's going to be the governor for the next 4 years, and he's done a lot of things that people do agree with, and we hope he'll do more things that we want. But it was very important to bring those two branches of the party together around a decision that there be things that, you know, significant commitments around the agenda that's important to us. So, and that kind of took two parts, politics and policy. I think it's, you know, a strong feeling for really all the different branches of the party and all the different players of the party and the governor himself that the Senate we have right now is unwilling to pass progressive policies on a whole range of issues, and that as long as the Senate leadership and the Senate stays the same, really none of the things we care about, or very few of them, are going to make progress. So that was some place where we had common ground. The governor, while he hadn't said so until Saturday, was feeling a lot of frustration with the difficulty of getting the Senate to pass things, you know, like the barriers we had around public funding of elections, which had been a big campaign we had been doing jointly with him. And the party was even more frustrated with the fact that the IDC Republican coalition has just been such a barrier to all of the things that we're working on. So the number one, you know, agreement in our conversations together was that we would take that common ground and work together. The unions affiliated with the WFP, the mayor of New York City, the governor, and the WFP would all work together to take back the Senate, so we'd have Democratic control and an ability to move a serious issue agenda on the issue areas that we're concerned about and that the governor is concerned about. So that was, you know, step one. And then in addition to that, a lot of our people wanted to be sure that if we take back the Senate, that it's clear what some of those things would be that would be on the issue agenda for passage in 2015, and that we would all be in agreement going into this, that those things would be top priorities for the Senate, for us, and for the governor. And the things that the specific issues that he spoke to us about on Saturday were passing public funding of elections, which, as you guys know, would really shift control of our elections away from the big money donors to average ordinary New Yorkers, and be critical for our ability to pass all the other pieces of legislation in the long term. The DREAM Act, which has been stalled, but is critically important to immigrant students and young people. The decriminalization of marijuana, which has been making some progress in the legislature but still hasn't gotten passed and is very important in communities of color to start to fight back and reduce the incredible problems of mass incarceration of young people of color. The women's equality agenda, the full women's equality agenda with all of the provisions in it. And then the biggest new piece that was very, very important to us was the governor made a strong commitment to raising the minimum wage, to raising it statewide to 10-10, indexing that to inflation so we don't have to have this fight every year, and then also allowing localities to raise it up to 30% higher within a framework of state regulations. And then he also spoke to education, not all the things that we would like on education, but some significant commitments around 100 community schools to match the 100 community schools the mayor is doing in New York City, 100 community schools in the rest of the state, and working on the funding formula to improve the distribution of funds to poor and high-need districts.
Is there a commitment to work on the funding formula?
There is a commitment to work on the funding formula. It's not clear what exactly that means and what it means in terms of dollar amounts, but there was a commitment in his speech on Saturday night that we need the funding formula to fix some of the things that make it not as fair as it could be, but I think even more than that, to actually go by the funding formula rather than all of the political deals that get made around distribution.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
We do have to actually fund it for it to be wonderful. So
yes,
that's the part that's still a little unclear.
There's a few things that are unclear, but one of the things I wanted to just touch on, in the last week, there's a new name in politics, and it's Zephyr Teachout. No one I had actually heard of before, but certainly she kind of caught fire throughout the week, and a lot of people were paying attention to her. She was one of the names that was put out there as a potential gubernatorial candidate for the WFP. She did get about 42% of the vote. I guess I'm wondering, what does the future hold for Zephyr Teachout? Despite the fact that she didn't get the nod from the Working Families Party, is she still going to be working with the party, or how do you see this? How do you see her role in the party moving forward?
I mean, she's got to make her own personal decisions now, which obviously I'm not involved in now. We're with the governor.
Right.
But she certainly was a great potential candidate. We were excited about her as another option if we didn't feel comfortable with the where the governor's program was going to be for next year. But now that we feel comfortable with the governor's program for next year, we're with him. I think she is a great spokesperson for the basic issues of economic justice. And has actually quite a bit of expertise on the economy and the kinds of things that would need to be done to change the incredible concentration of economic power that has also turned into a concentration of political power. And those set of issues are going to be core to the party going forward in the future, as they have been in the past, but as they're getting crystallized more and more, that connection between economic power and concentration of economic power and concentration of political power is what's the barrier to so many of the things that we believe are needed for poor and working people in New York State. It's a set of issues that she brought to the table that we're looking forward to understanding better and better. I think, if she is interested in working with the party in the future and running for some other office, we would be interested in talking with her. I know she has said publicly that she's still considering running the Democratic primary. Obviously, if she does that, we're not going to have anything to do with it.
Is the WFP convention like the Democratic and Republican state conventions, at which candidates who get at least a certain percentage of the delegate votes are allowed to run in the primary without collecting petition signatures?
So yes, except as Frank's saying, that at the state election laws, if you get 25% of the vote at a state convention, you can run a primary in that party without collecting signatures. But the difference in this situation is because because Zephyr is not a WFP registrant, she's a Democrat, she also has to get, we were talking before, a Wilson-Pakula, which is authorization of a non-party member to run, whether it's primary or general, and that requires a 50% vote. So even though she had over 25% in the nomination vote, she can't run in the primary unless she had also gotten 50% agreeing to give her Wilson-Pakula, which obviously did not happen. So she's not able to primary.
Kevin, Karen, Mike Powell in the New York Times today wrote a piece in which he basically expressed his skepticism that the governor would follow through with some of the promises he made to the WFP this weekend. How does the WFP plan on holding the governor's feet to the fire on these promises?
First of all, let me say that I think that the governor is quite serious about the promises. But secondly, you know, it's going to be, as played out in the media, the mayor of New York City has played a very heavy role in bringing the WFP and the governor together. And he's going to continue to play that role, I believe, of making sure that first step one here is taking back the Senate, and that's a political set of activities that the mayor, the big unions that are involved with the WFP that also were involved in wanting the WFP to endorse the governor, the mayor and the unions are all going to be involved in seeing that process forward, making sure that joint resources between the unions and the Democrats are going toward that. And so that's going to be the key process, is that electoral process of making sure we have a Senate that wants to do these issues. And that's really, there's a lot of ability to make that happen because of the unions and the mayor, and the governor himself seems quite committed to doing that. Once we take back the Senate, we obviously have to move the issue agenda. I don't think the governor's going to change his positions on any of these issues, but of course, like any issue campaign, we're going to have to do a huge push to get them done. We're going to have to make sure that this new Senate is committed to these issues as well, and that once they're in, that the Senate and the Assembly work together to move the issues in a way that is strong and forceful and that gets them passed in uncompromised versions that are going to really work for the people of New York State. And I think that's not dependent on just the governor. That's dependent on all of us to make sure that the legislature, and it's dependent on the legislative leaders as well, to make sure that these bills get passed.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I watched, I wasn't at the WFP convention, regrettably, but I did, follow
it. What, you missed it?
I did, unfortunately. I won't even tell you where I was, but I would have had a much better time at the WFP convention. I know that for a fact. But I guess I wanted to ask you a little bit. I mean, I watched the video message from the governor. I was very surprised at a lot of the things that he was committing to that you just articulated. And I have to say kudos to you for getting to come out publicly in support of all these kind of progressive policies. And I know, you're looking to hold his feet to the fire on a lot of this stuff. But I guess I'm wondering, given what he said about, restoring Democrats to power in the Senate, and kind of, feeling like this IDC coalition government is not working for him anymore. I guess I'm wondering, what do you think this means for the end of the session? I mean, does anything get done at this point? Or, how can it get done, really, I guess, is the question, now that you have this dynamic where the governor is at odds with the IDC and the Republicans who are currently, in charge of the Senate.
Yep, no, that's a really good point. I mean, it's obviously up to the Republicans and IDC how they want to handle this at this point. I wouldn't be surprised if their decision is, the governor's at war with us, we're at war with him, therefore nothing more is going to happen the rest of session. That could very well be the outcome. There wasn't a lot that probably would have happened between now and the end of session anyway, although there's definitely some big things on the table that people were trying to get done. They were all kind of going to be tough to get done regardless as people are moving into electoral mode. But I do think that this is going to make it much harder for things to move electorally, unless the Republicans and the IDC decide that it's important to them electorally on some of these issues that are on the table for the end of session, that they get done for their own reelection chances. And that's a possibility as well.
Right. So you got a situation now.
And I think, by the way, just specifically on the minimum wage, local wage bill, that's one bill that really didn't look like it had a chance for end of session. And now, in a lot of ways, it would be in the self-interest of the Senate majority coalition to actually get it passed and take it off the table as an electoral issue. So I think there's, in an odd way, more of a chance of it passing than there was before.
Huh. I don't know if Dean Skelos would agree with you on that.
Very well, you may be right.
the organization I used to be the director of, the Fiscal Policy Institute, I saw on their website that they posted testimony they delivered yesterday at a Senate Labor Committee hearing on minimum wage and local control of minimum wage. I was surprised to see that the Senate is actually having a hearing on this subject. That is a positive sign in a way. Do you know much about the status of the minimum wage talks in the Senate?
I don't know what's going on in terms of the inside talks, but I do know that the campaign to raise the minimum wage has been pushing really hard for this to be an end-of-session issue. It, as I said, it seemed kind of dead until the weekend. Now that the governor is on board, the campaign's reinvigorated. There was a, you know, quite that hearing yesterday had already been scheduled by the Senate Labor Committee. And now that day had a lot of fast food workers and low-wage workers were up and were testifying and were lobbying, and I think there's a lot of momentum and motion. We had a great press conference with the Senate Democrats where they, you know, expressed their strong support for getting this done. And, you know, that it's been a set of issues that the IDC, at least, is not necessarily – it's been in support of, at least to some degree, on some parts of it. I could see them becoming more strongly in support right now, and I don't know what that does in terms of the final Senate dynamics for getting it passed.
So, Karen, let me follow up with a question here. I mean, I know, you know, there's some dissatisfied WFP members out there that Cuomo got the nod for governor. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, what do you say to those members who were a bit disillusioned with the party because of this decision? You know, obviously, this is a party where, you know, it's a real unified party. Everybody's on message. Everybody is talking about the same issues. But what do you say to those members who are currently pretty disillusioned with the party?
I think they need to give take a deep breath, step back, and give us some time to show what the results of this are. And if the results of this are that we have a Democratic Senate and we're able to pass the five issues I mentioned and make some progress on education, then I think they should reconsider how they feel about this decision. That would be huge steps forward. And I know a lot of people that wanted to supported Zephyr and wanted to do that run feel like it's important to have a very long-term vision and put out our entire, you know, vision and agenda in the context of this election cycle. I can understand that. That's something that, you know, would have played a really important role. But to me, the party's job is to make sure that poor and working class people in New York State have a better life. And this is a path to getting that done and getting it done in a substantial way in 2015. And so if we succeed in doing that, I think they'll see that and they'll come back and they'll feel like it was the right decision in the end. But, you know, we've got a year until we see what the results of this are.
Some people actually believe that the majority coalition is a little bit to the left of the policies that the governor has pursued since he's been governor. What do you think about that?
That's not been my experience. to me, the majority coalition, while the IDC has been, you know, had solid positions in a lot of issues that we've worked on, the majority coalition gives the Republicans basically veto power over what can move forward. And so, you know, for example, in the issue that I've worked on the most this year, public funding of elections, as much as the IDC were championing of it, it has gone nowhere because the Republicans kept saying no. So by giving Dean Skelos the power to have veto power of whatever the IDC might want, it forces us to have a Senate majority that is more conservative than the governor and more conservative by far than what a Democratic majority would be.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we have been speaking with Karen Scharf, the Executive Director of Citizen Action of New York State and one of the co-chairs of New York State's Working Families Party. Karen, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Karen.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy. We're with you on the first Tuesday of every month, except when it doesn't work out, and then we're here on a different Tuesday. But I think we'll be here on Tuesday, July 1st. Before we finish up, just mention that besides the issues Controller DiNapoli talked about earlier in our show, he also issued an important report last week on a topic that we've been following here on the People's Business, the economic pluses and minuses of casino gambling. And one of the things the Controller pointed out in his report is that this, while the casino gambling will aggregate some money, it's going to take money away from other aspects of the economy. And I just want to close with a quote from the Controller's report. Because of this substitution effect that spending on losses, so to speak, at casinos comes from something that people would spend money on otherwise. Because of this substitution effect, estimates of employment and revenue gains from new casinos must reflect potential losses and transfers of existing consumer spending. The report found that while some net employment gain is expected, some existing jobs are expected to be lost as well. So I think that's an important caution from the Controller. This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. Please join us again on Tuesday, July 1st, and now stay tuned for Democracy Now!
Thank you.